Pod. Pod.
How bad, mate, are you?
Yeah, not bad. I was just in a meeting room and got chucked out, so I've had to make way to my car to have a chat. the glamours of working in an office now.
So yeah, I've got Tony. Is it Francesca?
Frankie, you can call me Frankie. I've moved. It used to be Frankie, but I've moved to my professional name, Francesco.
All right. So yeah, you both based. Are you from down south?
Yeah, we're from a place called Leighton Buzzard, but Frankie's now further up your way.
Yeah, I'm in Cheshire now. I live in Cheshire. Yeah.
So yeah, thanks for getting in touch, mate. Needed something, a bit different. Gets like quite samey some of the episodes, so get a bit of a different angle from you guys, I reckon.
Yeah, the podcast is brilliant. It's so nostalgic for it. Like, I came across it recently. And it was a friend of mine actually that mentioned it to me. I was like, no way, I'll have a listen to this. And it just floods the memory. Just think, oh my God, it feels like a different lifetime ago. It's just so strange. That's when I sent it over to you, wasn't it, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Rekindled a few memories. That's
yeah. Are you, how old are you guys then?
35.
I'm 35. Yeah, both 35. Okay.
Slightly older than me then, yeah. So yeah, take us back to that time then, like, what were you up to? Why did you start the band and how did it go, kind of thing?
I think the starting of the band, we were having a chat about this last night, weren't we? And
It kind of
started for just loving the music of the time and listening to all these bands, you know, being heavily influenced by Libertines and Paddingtons and Cribs and everyone else. And we just kind of, it started off in Frank's garage with some homemade wine and
it
was just covers. We were just playing covers. And then as we were playing gigs, you know, people were quite into it in our area, which I don't think we fully expected, because we're kind of in a no man's land between Milton Keynes and London.
Oh, okay.
And so we started playing these little gigs and it was gaining quite a lot of interest. So we attempted writing our own songs, and one of the lads, Tom, who was lead guitarist in the band, he couldn't make the call today, but he was probably the lead writer in the band. And some of the early stuff we wrote was pretty bad, but it was fun.
Further back from that, me and Tony, we were in the same year at school. We've been best friends for years prior to that. We'd always, you know, been into music. I was a musician, but couldn't play any instrument that you could associate with a band at that point. So it was like, we love these songs. We'd love to play them. So I was like, oh, I can learn guitar. You know, it seems pretty easy. So I think we learned about 3 or 4 chords, and we'd just sit around, play anything that had those 4 chords in it that we could find online. And then we got Tom involved, didn't we? And he'd been playing guitar for years, so he was teaching me chords. And then we just got this set list of all these songs that we loved. Like, we played some Paddington songs. We had 50 to a Pound, Up the Bracket by the Libertines, some Day Pretty Thing stuff, some Baby Shambles stuff, you know, just a mismatch of as much as we could. And then I said to you boys last night that the only songs I could play on guitar were the songs in our set list. That was it. I knew nothing beyond that whatsoever. So it's just a matter of getting those together. And then, songs grew from that, really, didn't it? Like, drawing our influences from them. And then, we'd just play. We were saying last night, because we asked each other, didn't we? Like, why did we even do it? And it was just basically to play the songs we loved to our mate. That was essentially how it started. We'd play, and that was it.
Yeah, just started in your, as we said, it started in your garage, just having a laugh, and then took it to
cramming people
some
into
very
the garage, and then
took it to very small venues in the local town and local area, and just grew from there.
Yeah. So what year was this, do you think?
It must have been about... You would just finish uni, hadn't you? So it must have been about...
No, I just started uni.
Had you? Wow. Is it that long
ago? Yeah. It was like 2003, 2004. I think 2004.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably more accurate. Yeah.
Must have been that far back.
Right. So it's quite towards the start, really, when everything was like still very exciting, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, it was very exciting, it was a bit of a bubble, wasn't it? It wasn't like... It certainly wasn't mainstream, and what we were doing was certainly not mainstream. There was a real like niche for it, it was a scene growing. Tell it was growing, but we were just bubbling in the background until probably till about 2007 when we first started playing like bigger venues and bigger crowds and doing that sort of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're plugging away for a few years, and before things got traction, or how did it work?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That was it. Like, we, as we say, we were just playing small venues, and there was no real intention to write songs. We were just happy playing, you know, the songs of our era, that bubble, like you say, that we were in. And it just, we started to get a real strong gathering. Wherever we play, we'd have the same faces kind of come into the gigs, and It just started going from there, really. So we thought we'd write our own songs. The songs went down quite well and were kind of, I guess, relatable to where we were living and everything. And it just kind of kicked it on a little bit from there. And I think that's where we really decided to actually put a bit of effort into it and see if we can make something out of this.
How were you spreading the music? Was it MySpace at that point, or how did it work?
Yeah.
So it was all. I mean, we were still quite. In the age of going out and handing them, you know, if we wanted to get hold of any AR or anything like that, it was very much still like the postal era. So we were sending them out, we were handing out, but the amount of money, we said this last night, didn't we? The amount of money we must have spent on just handing out CDs and whatever else just to anyone that wanted one.
It was the recording as well that was expensive, because a lot of the venues that we wanted to play at, especially in London, wouldn't allow you to pay them until, you know, you had an EP or your own song, or a CD with at least your own song. Then we had to spend a load of money on recordings and stuff. The recordings were saying absolutely dreadful. but we needed them. You know, we'd have these three or four tracks, maybe a bit more, recorded at Runway Studios. Do you remember those?
Yeah, an old airfield that had been turned into a studio. Yeah. That was a pretty cool place, but yeah. Yeah, that was it. So we got those three or four recordings done and shipped them off to venues in the earlier days, and there was quite a bit of success from that, really, wasn't there? We did okay with that. Certainly in the London bubble, we got to play at some pretty decent venues around about that time.
Was that quite useful? And like, how far away were you from London? Like an hour away or something?
A 30-minute train.
Right.
Or, you know, you had to lump your gear around and everything else in back then as well. So probably an hour away, probably an hour.
Yeah, me and Tom both had Clios, didn't we? We had one
shoving it all in the back of
guitar cases and one in the back of a drum set and the other one. Did you just drive down the motorway to London? Two little cars.
So did you feel like part of a local scene, or was your local scene London then? Or how did it work, do you think?
I think, you know, you don't want to come across as sounding pretentious, is not the right word, but I think Leighton Buzzard, there wasn't a scene really. I think we were pretty much it, which, you know, kind of works in our favour, where when you're playing gigs in the local area, we, you know, everyone would come and watch us.
Right, okay.
We had a venue that was called the Library. I mean, that was literally a room on top of a library, and had a nice stage and probably held about 400 or 500 people or something, didn't it, Frank? And we play there quite regularly, and you know, sold out. It's quite special. Like when you're essentially a nobody and you've got a queue around the corner to come and watch you play a gig. It was, you know, that those kind of things were always nice feeling. But yeah, I think on the wider scale, we were always considered to be like a London band.
Right, okay. And did, you know, we talked to some bands you know, like the Paddingtons, for instance, who kind of focused on London, I think, to start with anyway. Did you feel the need to play elsewhere in the country, or was there so much going on in London that you were all right there, kind of thing?
It was definitely, to begin with, a London thing. We tried to, because every single, you know, certainly in the days of MySpace, you'd look at every other band and it was London, England, London, England, London, England. So we tried a different approach and made it very well known that we were from Leighton Buzzard,
right. But
wanted to play in London and wanted to play in other towns around us. Like, you know, there's some good little venues around Hitchin that Rifles made famous, and
Club 85.
Milton Keynes.
That's it, Club 85. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So playing those kind of venues, I think because we were in Leighton Buzzard, we got quite a nice little circled area that we could hit on and play and get, you know, you grab little groups of followers from each of those places and they tended to follow you into London, which is always a nice thing.
And I went to uni in Leeds, so I knew quite a few of the venues over there and a few contacts. So we used to go a bit further afield, but it, you know, you'd end up playing to literally nobody because we'd had this following in London and it, you know, we just felt better there having people actually come to the gigs rather than trekking all the way up the M1 to Leeds, or I think we trekked up to Newcastle and Scarborough, Middlesbrough, Hartlepool, yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the same. You know, you'd get a crowd down, but it certainly wasn't the same. We just felt part of the crowd in London because there was that, you know, that thing bubbling. And the venues were just brilliant because people just came out to watch gigs. And that was the important thing, really.
Did you ever make it to Hull at any point?
I feel like we did, but I think probably because of Paddingtons, we would have known that we were playing in Hull. Right. I was actually thinking about that last night, and I can't remember if we actually played in Hull or not.
There's a night called
actually,
Sesh that put on a lot of out-of-town bands. It would have been that, I think, if you did.
The what? What was it called?
The Sesh on a Tuesday night. So a pub called Linnet.
It could well have been. I mean, I feel in the back of my head that we definitely played there, but I feel we kind of did that. If we played a venue that someone that we had kind of been listening to and really followed had, if they had kind of played there and made it well known, it kind of stuck in the mind, but for some reason Hull doesn't stick, so I don't know if we ever did, you know.
Fair play. It's not a memorable place. Yeah.
We had we were talking about this last night actually, Harry. We remembered that Tom from the Paddingtons came to watch us at the Cuban bar in Camden, didn't he?
Oh really?
Yeah.
We bumped into him. We were handing flyers out around the time. We had a gig there and we handed a flyer out. We saw it. We were like, oh, sorry, you better get down, man. Come on, get down. And I think he did. But we also bumped into Faris from The Horrors on the same day. And we go, come on, lad, come down. He's like, nah, mate, not coming.
Not interesting.
Not interesting.
It was quite, I tell you, that was interesting when Tom came down, actually, because we had a little chat after, and I think Paddingtons had just gone a bit of a hiatus, and he started a new band, and I can't remember the name of it now. It was straight off the back of Paddingtons. You'll probably know it more than me.
They want
it was something in the Spacemen or something like that.
Tom Josh and the Astronauts. I mean?
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
And we went. He got us in to watch them as well. Frankie had gone back to Manchester at that point, so he couldn't go, but I think it was myself and one of the other band members, Alex, we went down to watch them. They were playing somewhere in Islington.
Yeah, I went to
it was
Union Chapel.
Did you? That was it, Union Chapel.
With Adam Green, wasn't it?
Yeah, with Adam, yeah.
So
he got us, after on the back of that, he got us down to watch him. So it was quite a nice moment. But that's about as far as our interaction went with the Paddingtons, I think, didn't it, unfortunately?
I was quite young at that time, but I was friends with bands. Or I remember I had a family friend who was in a band in 2004, and like they were offered management and stuff like that. How did it work with stuff like that? Were you doing things off your own back, or did we offer management at any point?
We had, I mean, we didn't necessarily get bombarded with chances to be signed, to be honest. I mean, we had a few offers, but we was forever had offers of management. We had a mate of ours, Byron, who's still
he's really busy,
very much one of
busy
our best
Byron.
Mates.
So, busy Byron. So he was very good as a manager.
he just, you know, you'd say to him, "Bye, and we, you know, we want to go and play. We've got February free. Fill it up for us, mate." And he'd just crack on and just and just fill up the calendar for us. And he'd do everything. He'd sort out all of our travel. So yeah, it works out really well for us. In the early days, it was very much us.
I think, but we Byron did get loads of people that used to cut, you know, trying to get on the bandwagon, like promised you the world, and yeah, you know, play these venues, we'll sort this out for you, and you'll be signed, you know, all of this.
We had going back to the early days when we first started writing songs. There was a local DJ from Leighton Buzzard who worked on Heart, and he kept playing our songs. We didn't even know, had no idea he was playing our songs. Didn't, you know. He entered us without even telling us. He entered us into a like a battle of the bands over the radio competition, and we won it. We had absolutely no idea, but we won it. But the prize,
there's loads of bands that went down, weren't there?
Yeah. There's almost every local band. But the prize was to support McFly in Milton Keynes. So it's kind of like, what the fuck? This is not really how. This is not really us. Right? It's not really our scene. But we went.
Yeah,
anyway.
We won it.
So we won it, and we kind of weighed it up, and it was like, well, look, we're brand new. We've been playing in the Crawford Arms and Renoirs and loads of other little local pubs that hold 20 people. We've been offered a gig to play in front of 25,000 people. We can't really turn it down. So we went ahead and done it.
Yeah. 25,000. Men's up. It was absolutely nuts. And we were talking about it last night. We just remember going and out the back of it, you know, the crowd was filling up. And we had sound check. Like, oh my God, I can't believe how many people are actually here. Like screaming girls. Like, it was just mental. And our mate Byron, he'd sorted loads of stuff out, and he'd made these like 200 t-shirts with our name on it. We were selling, flogging these out the front. And then he was like, right, lads, what do you want on your rider? You know, you've got a rider for this. Like, oh my God, that's brilliant. We're just like, just get us loads of crates and pile it. So we get in. Everybody else had like food and water and all sorts. And all we had was crates.
From going from a pub to playing that, we hadn't quite worked out what a rider was, had we?
No. So we didn't order any food. We had a bottle of water each, and that was it. Just loads of cans of garlic. But yeah, it was quite a young crowd, wasn't it? We're saying about
yeah.
We were like, right, we need to pick four songs to play. So we had to pick the one song that won the competition. So that was done. Like, what are the three songs that piss off the crowd and blow them out? And we had one song, like one of the earliest songs we wrote. It was awful, such a bad song. It's called Petra. And the opening line is, "Petra, you're a naughty girl. You've been up all night. You look like shite. That's your world." And we opened up with that. It was just awful. Oh my God.
There's a lot of shocked parents
there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because on the back of that, you know, our MySpace went from like 200 people to 3,000 or 4,000 overnight, literally, just from that gig. And when you're then trying to get into venues or book places, then look at your MySpace and think, flipping out, these lads have got loads of followers or whatever. And that really helped out. It gave us a massive boost, didn't it?
Yeah. Off the back of that as well, we had it was part of the deal was that you'd get a record deal in inverted commas, because
and a tour, wasn't it? A tour and a record deal.
A tour, yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, we kind of started looking at the nooks and crannies of what we were actually being offered. And it was basically selling the rights to your song that won the competition for all intents and purposes. And, you know, I think we were quite lucky that we got an intelligent bunch in the band. And we kind of looked at it from a more leveled playing field and kind of trying to get our heads around what it was. And when you looked into it, I mean, had we accepted that, it was just being totally taken for a ride and having your song stolen off of you. So we were quite, I'm always pleased that we actually held our ground and said no to that. Cause it's quite, I mean, we'd gone from, like I say, playing to 20 people to 25,000. It's very easy to then just have a deal put in front of you and be like, yeah, fuck it, we'll sign it. But I still to this day, even though we never actually ended up with a record deal, I still to this day am I'm happy that we never actually sold our souls in that record deal.
Oh, okay.
But we were talking about it last night about how it was so obvious what's going on, because we went in to record the track and he wanted a B side, two tracks on the B side. We were talking about it last night, weren't we? And he had us up literally all night recording this second track. And it was just everything that we didn't want in a song. It's like putting effects on it, beats on it, and all of this stuff. It's just like, nah, this ain't right. This ain't right. And I remember leaving there about 3 or 4 in the morning, going back the next morning, and him putting it on for us. We're like, nah, nah, we're not having this. It's absolutely dreadful. What have you done to our song? Like, what have you done to it?
And then pulling me aside and asking me how I'd feel about turning it into a dance song as well. I was like, nah, we need to. I think we're done here now, mate.
Sounds like, how quickly can you sell out within the space of a week or something?
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's it. And I think that you just think across the country how many kind of bands got suckered into that, and we were right on the edge of it. And, you know, yeah, you get a song and you can kind of tell everybody at this age now that you release a song or whatever, but it never once felt right, did it? And that's just kind of where we went with it.
Are you the same, Frankie? Any no regrets about not signing, that kind of thing?
Yeah, no regret. It was a period where we were really focused on it. You know, we all had small part-time jobs. I think, yeah, Tom left his job, didn't he, in Glasgow, moved back down south. So it was, you know, we spent a load of money on buying this 50 Royal Mail van that someone had previously converted into a tour bus. So it had like all these guitar racks in the back and beds in the front and stuff. And we all chipped in, bought that, and we're just going up and down the country playing music that we love. And that, I think, when it all boils down to it, that's what we love. That's what made it for us, rather than the stories of selling out venues, crowds. And although that's brilliant, you know, playing to full venues and stuff, that wasn't why we loved it. It wasn't to get a record deal and, you know, go on world tours and stuff. It was just to have good laugh and just enjoy.
We were late teens, early 20s, weren't we? So it was just, you know, all of those kids now, they go out and have a good time. We were just doing it in a different way. We were getting to kind of play music at the same time as having, I guess, a booze up with your mates. And, you know, all of our mates were at that age. So I think it happens with every single band. We had our entire friendship group would come along to pretty much every single gig. So after the gig's done, it's a night out. And that's what we loved about it. You'd basically get a free night out anywhere you wanted in the country. And that was kind of, and you got to kind of sing your songs that you wanted to sing at the same time. So it was always such a good laugh.
Just going back to that competition, and what song was it, out of interest? Is it one that you sent me that won it?
It wasn't. It's too painful to sell you the song. So, I mean, it got, after we probably got to about 8 or 9 songs, that one was very quickly dropped. It was very, you could kind of, when you look back, you can kind of see why it was chosen to kind of work alongside McFly, because it had very much like a poppy feel to it. And
right.
It wasn't really.
A lot of our songs had a poppy feel, though. Really, Harry, it wasn't as bad as he's making out. It's called Naughty. It was called Naughty Girls.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, I never really enjoyed it anyway, the song, and I think we kind of dropped it as quick as we could. But
okay, I thought it might have been that one called "We're All Right." I thought that was probably the best one you sent me. Enjoyed that one.
Yeah, we used to love playing that live. That used to go crazy, didn't it?
That was always a popular song. That was a good story behind that song as well. It was good. It's nice when you got a story behind a song.
And just one more about that gig. What venue was it? Was it a massive venue, or was it like a more of a festival?
Campbell Park. It was outdoors.
Right.
Yeah. So it's they were doing at the time like I think they had about 5 or 6 shows up and down the country, just play, I guess, kind of like a stadium tour.
Right.
And we got put onto the, can't remember who else he had supporting we got put on the bill, yeah.
Javine. I remember Javine was playing.
Ah, I remember that vaguely, that name, yeah. Yeah. But didn't she have like one big single or something?
Yeah.
No
they
idea.
They just played T4 on the beach. Do you remember that in Brighton?
Yeah, I remember that one.
Oh,
yeah.
They got a helicopter.
And they got, we're there with our two crates of beer on our rider, and they got a helicopter from South to Milton Keynes. Yeah. Bit different.
I always remember T4 on the beach because that's where one of Jedward broke the leg, wasn't it? I don't know why I remember
that. Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I was in a band at that point. Sounds like you got a lot further than us, but I remember we went from like writing songs and having a laugh, you know, doing it to have a good time. So at one point, it kind of came like, I don't know, it seemed to get a lot more serious to me. I had this idea that we needed to be signed.
Yeah.
Stop being fun very quickly. Like, did you never have that attitude? You always tried to like keep it fun kind of thing.
No, I think we were saying this last night. I mean, what I've found really frustrating, and I guess there's like a section of jealousy in there as well. You'd hear like a new band come out, you'd hear something in NME or, you know, on whatever radio station or MySpace, and you see it, they've been signed a plat, and you'd think, fuck me, that's not even a patch on what we're doing. And it's like, what are they doing that we're not to get signed? And at this time, you've kind of quit your job and you're working like 3 days a week to kind of keep doing what you're doing. Yeah, and you're getting paid like you're going all the way up to Manchester to a brilliant gig. I mean, Manchester we seemed to do really well in, didn't we? But anyway, and you'd get, I don't know, between the five of us, 300 quid for your troubles. And I mean, it's gone that night. Then it's kind of like rinse, repeat. And so you've got no money, and it takes its toll in the end. I think you're doing all of these gigs, and you're not getting what you kind of feel you deserve out of it. And it goes, like you say, from being fun and having a good laugh to we're actually quite good at this, and we should be getting a lot more reward than we're getting.
Yeah, we're remembering last night about a particular gig at the O2 Academy down in London, and we were supposed to be supporting this competition, and did we play first or last? I can never remember.
So they were doing a Battle of the Bands again.
Yeah, but we weren't in the Battle of the Bands.
No, so it was one of these again where I think we were supposed to play in the hall next door. And we turned up with about 300 odd people for this venue. The Battle of the Bands had kind of fallen flat on its ass, but the winner of it again got some form of record deal, whatever the record deal was, and
yeah, but it was playing in Bali.
You got to play like a random festival in Bali, yeah. Plus the band also gets X amount of money to record or something. So anyway, they said, look, I know you're playing there, but your support band or something hasn't turned up. Would you be interested in coming in and doing this one? So we did it, and you know, it went down really well, didn't it? I mean, it's probably one of the best gigs we ever played together.
I think so.
Pissed off every other band because we were not supposed to be part of the process,
and we ended up winning it.
It was the ability
to have that good a song, you know, so many good songs. I think you know, we were unique in that we were so tight, we were friends. I think the fact that we had a female drummer as well made us different. And you know, we had all that chemistry together, and we're like, fuck, why aren't we getting signed? Like, what is it that we're doing wrong? Is it just we don't know the right people? Like, what is it? We're playing all the right venues, and it was just something, wasn't it?
I think, as you might know as well, Harry, I mean, I think a big part of it was not necessarily what you were doing, it was right place, right time, because it was such a saturated genre at the time, wasn't it, that like you just got cherry picked out of it, and we were just the unfortunate ones that never got cherry picked. And like I say, some of the bands you heard of that era, it's like, fuck me, like how have they just made a record and we're still scratching around? And it always hurt me, probably more than the rest of you guys, I think, but I always really took that to heart for some reason.
Because when I think back at it, it was like there was almost these two rivals. It was like the underground unsigned lot, which was us, and like some really, really good bands at the time that were playing in London that were supporting us, or we were supporting them, or whatever it was. And then you had the elite lot, which were like the signed band. And like, we were doing nothing different to them, apart from the fact that they were getting promoted and pushed. But everything else was the same. And it was like, fuck you, like, you know, we're happy here, whatever. But really, we were all striving to be that other group. But, you know, when you look back at it, it's quite nice that we were that underground cult scene that we loved being in. And you think back at the bands there, and it's just like, flipping out, there are some really good bands.
And it kind of creates its own little bubble within the bubble as well. Like, we made
really good
friends with a couple of other bands, to the point where a band called the Wootars that we became really good friends with from High Wycombe. We ended up having the lead singer of the Wootars ended up being our bass player for years, and we're still good friends now. And it was kind of those kind of relationships that were definitely the plus side of it.
Yeah, their lead singer, the Wootars, when we met them, he'd just left. He'd gone to be in a band called Dry the River. You heard of them, Harriet?
I think so. Don't know.
They're a really good band, actually. We saw them at Glastonbury.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're a really good band. But, you know, it's bands like that. Flipping brilliant. But the Wootars, they were good because they had access to some really good venues. And their promoter at the time, she lived at Filthy Nasty's, didn't she? In Pete Doherty's old bedroom.
Pete Doherty used to live in, yeah. Right. And so the reason we wanted to get in with them, being 20-year-old kids, was because we thought we might get to see Pete Doherty's old room at Filthy Nasty's. And that's kind of how the relationship started.
Just blood splattered all over the walls.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Yeah, you mentioned that day when you saw Tom and then you saw Faris. Was it a bit like that in, especially Camden at the time, where it'd just be a who's who of NME kind of thing walking around?
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, everywhere. Everywhere around that area. If you had a gig, there was always somebody of some sort.
Is that in, that song from the Crips? Hey Seamsters.
It was. I mean, you'd play a venue. This happened so many times, but you'd play a venue, and next door in the bigger venue would be Paddington's or Cribs or whoever. Baby Shambles on one occasion, you know.
And we had the playing like next door to us in Manchester, didn't we?
Oh, literally in the room next door to us. Yeah.
We played Academy 3, and they're in Academy 2 in Manchester. Brilliant.
But yeah, it was just, yeah. So it was, I think that was the scene then. And it was, you know, you just kind of got on with it and, you know, you don't disturb too many people. I think Tom was a little bit different because Paddington's was one of the bands that kind of really made us sit up and give it a go. So kind of seeing him in the underground world, that he was obviously a major, major deal to us.
But it was their story as well that I think inspired us and thought, well, if they can do it, and same with The View, you know, just handing out CDs to the bus, the Baby Shambles bus, or I think it's just stuff like that. You think, flipping heck, if we hang around these venues or go to these places or, you know, whatever, maybe we'll get that opportunity. You know, I think that was quite great, wasn't it?
I think with Paddington's, like, one of their first few gigs, Alan McGee was there. It's like, that's kind of looking at you sometimes, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, exactly. there was a guy, I can't remember the guy's name now, but someone, Tom and I went down to meet, this is right at the end of Little Villains, and I think it was like one of the kind of like the final nails in the coffin where it was like, that's, I think it's game over. Someone came to watch us and invited us down, and Tom and I went to have a chat with him. I can't remember who, it was a management company, not a record deal. And just the things he was offering were,
it's like, you'd basically walk away with nothing, but there's a chance you might get notoriety out of it, and there's a chance you might get a record deal out of it. It's like, what are we doing? Like, you know, it's part of this has got to be fun, but at the same time, we still need to get some kind of payment now, or we've got, you know, we can't be broke living with our mums and dads for the rest of our lives. Like, we need to kind of move it on from this. Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name now, but or the company, but yeah, we got to a point where those kind of things just kept happening all the time, and we never got that little bit of luck. Go on.
The best one was the Warburtons guy, the bread guy. He said that he wanted to use one of our songs in a Warburtons advert.
Right.
Which, you know, at the time we kind of saw that as, you know, we're not getting kind of the recognition we deserve, I guess, that we thought we deserved. So we kind of saw that as a good thing. And the guy was wacky. I looked it up his name last night. His name was Lenny Payne. And he made Art on Toast.
Yeah, that was it.
It was the most bonkers thing you've ever seen in your life. He invited us to play a gig with Susie Quattro. But it was for a Dave Courtney. Have you heard of Dave Courtney, the gangster?
Vaguely, yeah. There's a Dave Courtney
like
in Hobbit, isn't
it? Celebrity gangster now. Right. And he was throwing
was it his birthday or something.
Yeah, it was like his 60th
at the London Aquarium. It was at the London Aquarium. The poor Susie Quattro.
And so we were in this room, a room full of gangsters. I always remember one image of some guy with slicked back hair, a snakeskin suit, and like a gun holster on his side. He's like, what the fuck are we doing here? And so we're the most surreal experience. But yeah, I mean, things like that, like just meeting characters like that, it does make it all worth it.
Yeah, it sounds like something from a Guy Ritchie film or something.
it was weird.
So what became of it? They wanted to use your song for an advert, but it didn't happen.
I think the advert never got commissioned in the end, right, or something. Right. But we were all set up. We gave the song and we'd given the license to use it and everything, but I just don't think the advert ever materialised.
Just thinking out, like that idea of, like now looking back, I think I'd 100% done that. But I remember at the time, the idea of selling out was massive, wasn't it? It was a big thing.
That was it.
It doesn't seem to be like that anymore, I don't think.
That was our conundrum. It's like, well, you've got to remember, if we ever kind of make it, as it were, off the back of this, we're always going to be known as the band that had a man running in a video in a Warburtons advert, and that was kind of the conundrum. Do we go with it or not?
Yeah, was it a giant piece of toast? It was like running through a city.
Yeah,
sounds it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you mentioned, you know, coming to the end of the band. Like, what year was that, and what was kind of the catalyst for calling it a day?
I think it must have been about.
Tony got his jaw broken. He won't admit it, but Tony got punched by a bouncer, had his jaw broken, so he couldn't sing for about 8 months. And then, you know, we had to cancel a load of gigs, and it was like, oh my God, we're getting on a bit here. Like, what do we do? Do we actually get a job? We're going to have to get some jobs now. And I had to.
You were up in Manchester, weren't you?
Yeah, and I'm a solicitor now, and at the time I was training, I had to finish that training. It was like, oh, what do we do? And it just kind of fizzled out, didn't it? And then Heather went off to Goldsmith. And then didn't she go on tour with Kajagoogoo, our drummer? I'm sure she went on a tour with Kajagoogoo.
I don't think it was Kajagoogoo. That's just a lady.
Was it not? Who was it?
She did tour with... Was they called... it's a female band. Actually pretty good.
Daughter or something like that, was it?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But she
I think it kind of went from a massive high to then all of a sudden just slowly fizzling out. And I think it was around about 2010 when we did it. The frustrating thing is we did an end show, didn't we?
Yeah, final show at Monto Water Rats.
Monto Water Rats. And it was probably one of the best ones we ever had. And it was kind of like, oh, should we keep going? And it was like, actually, no, let's call that the, let's leave it in that note.
Absolutely rammed, wasn't it? We used to love Pokemon. So, have you been there?
Water Rats, remember the name Water Rats, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably
have. It was a great venue. We ended up...
Yeah, it's kind in... where is it?
It's King's Cross.
King's Cross, and it's, that's it, yeah.
We almost become like a resident band, didn't we? We played there.
Yeah.
We must have played there over... probably somewhere between 10 and 20 times, but yeah, it's a great venue, so we always had to have that as the last one. Yeah, I don't know, it was a weird ending, wasn't it? It kind of, I don't think there was ever like an official that's it with that, it just fizzled out.
Yeah, I think so. I think what once you label a gig as the final gig or a farewell gig,
that's
You then take that, don't you? If you keep coming back,
yeah.
Well, one less member every time, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
That's definitely a good way of doing it, though. Going out on a high like that.
Yeah, it was.
Like, what was the high point? Do you think?
Definitely after that McFly gig when we
probably just had about
playing all the time.
A 2-year period where it seemed that no matter where we played, we had a crowd. And that was definitely the high point. I mean, we went to like, we had like a holiday 1 year. I mean, I always remember this gig and I can't remember the name of the venue, but we had like a holiday and we came back from the holiday straight into the gig and we'd done no promotion on it or anything. So we'd been on this lad's holiday and we turned up and there was probably over 150 people there to watch you. And it's like, fuck me. Like we're clearly doing something right. If we haven't even got a touch to promotion and we're still getting like 100. I think it was a Bull and Gate, actually.
Yeah, it was Bull and Gate.
Yeah. In Kentish Town.
Was that where we had a really good review as well? Was it in The Enemy?
Yeah.
About us? It was labeled London's best kept secret, I think. And like off the back of that, people used to come and watch us so much.
Yeah.
So much from that. And yeah.
And you kind of, you just kind of like, and we're getting such a gathering and, It just felt really good. Anywhere we went, we'd go up to Manchester and play a gig like the one we were talking about with Rifles, and we'd end up with, you know, into the hundreds worth of people. And it's like, this is something's going right here. This is, we're going somewhere. And then,
it's mainly the London circuit. Like, we were playing like 100 Club, we were selling that. Barfly Camden, we were selling that one out. You know, really good small venues, but we were getting really good crowds in.
Dublin Castle, all of those. So that was definitely the high point. I think that was around about 2007, 2008.
Yeah, it was.
It was, great time.
You know, we talked a lot about, you know, when was the best time to get signed and all that. I guess if that's your high point, at the same time, that's when the internet's kicking in and everything and the landscape started to shift a bit. Is that how you think it played out a bit, that it wasn't the same... like playing field it was in like 2004?
I think that probably come end of 2008, kind of, you know, just trying to think through the years, probably around about 2009, 2010, I think things had really started to switch on to the music platforms. Like, I don't think Spotify existed then, but you had your iTunes and even the illegal ones like LimeWire or whatever they're called, had really kind of kicked in. And I think that was that was the end of it, really.
I'm telling you now,
and the X Factor, seriously, you just get to sit in front of your TV or in front of your computer and listen to music. Why would you go out and listen to a band? And I think there was a lot more of that than people probably gave credit. I always remember, I don't know what year it was, but Vaccines, they kind of came out. And it felt like they were the only band left doing it. That's how it always felt to me. Like there was you had Vaccines on the radio followed by Lady Gaga and some other
crap. Went to watch the Vaccines. Remember the Libertines?
Yeah. Play?
And it was Libertines, the Vaccine, and who else was it? Some
Rifles and some. This was in Hyde Park, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I remember thinking, right, I think this is the end. Like, It felt like it, didn't it? It felt that was the end of guitar music for us. And we'd finished playing at that point. And there was just nothing out there anymore. I also think it might have something to do with the fact that record labels, especially the big ones, just weren't prepared to take a punt on, you know, kids playing venues anymore. So at the end of the day, it is a liability. You know, look at some of the bands around. They weren't like The View and people like that were just nutters. And you think, well, why would a record label take a punt on people like that? And I think you kind of just think,
oh, that was, fuck it. But that was it, wasn't it? Like, we had, I guess, in a much smaller world, we had almost a similar reputation as well, didn't we? Like, where, you know, it was as much about having the good time as it was about what you were doing with the music. And yeah, I think that's right. I think we did, I think we fell victim of that. I mean, it's a tough one to call. I think now, like, I think that's one of the other questions you had. Like, I'd hate to, oh, I don't think we would be doing this now, because I just don't think there's a market for it anymore, which is tragic. Like, you don't hear of, you know, going down to Monto Water Rats and, you know, having 400 people there to watch a band that no one's ever heard of. That just, I might be wrong because I'm 35 now, but that just doesn't seem to happen.
No, it definitely seems like that to me. But I guess one of the big themes of this podcast is, are we getting old, or is it a lot different now? But I suppose the truth in both. But yeah, it definitely seems a lot different.
Yeah.
And like you said, it just seems a lot safer now for some reason.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, it's easier to just sit in a studio and you know,
fabricate.
Go to town on the fabrication of a song, yeah, and not really put too much effort into it. Like, whereas we were very much the opposite to that. We wanted to, our recordings, we wanted to kind of keep as live as we possibly could. And I just don't think you just wouldn't be allowed to do that now, I don't think.
Yeah, you said you don't really have any regrets, but is there anything you would do differently about that time?
I think Frankie touched on it earlier about the list of gigs that we'd take on. I mean, you know, you'd go and play a random pub in Nottingham on a Wednesday night, and you hadn't put, because you'd been gigging elsewhere for a few weeks on end, you hadn't put enough preparation into it, and you might turn up and there'd only be 5-10 people there. And it's kind of like, we need to kind of have a better outlay on what we're doing. And that's where we
just
really
be more selective of the, the gigs we played. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where we kind of decided that in and around London was the better tactic to build up a following.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest regret is trying to go too far afield too early on.
I remember Steve Lamack telling us that our name was rubbish. We should change it because no one can find it.
Yeah, we went on Radio 6. Was it Radio 6 that he used to do it? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And it was quite good. He spotted us and found us through MySpace and wanted to feature us on it.
Oh, cool.
But he really struggled to say our name. I think I even read it to you in an email, like, just to be sure, like, this is how it's pronounced. It's always because of what Steve Lamack did. And I think I went on and spoke to him, and before I'd even started, he just absolutely caned us about our name.
And was always like,
what's the point in being an unsigned band and having a name that no one can pronounce? Like, then I never really thought about that.
I remember going to watch The View, Tony, and after the gig, we went back with them into this room in Bedford, it was. And they were going, oh, lads, what, have you got any stuff on you or whatever? We're like, no, got nothing. Hey, they sent off their manager to go and get a plastic bag full of marker pens and buds. We just
sat to get a buzz. That was a weird. Can you remember? We everywhere we went, it was really strange for about 6 months or something like that. It seemed every single time we went to a new town for a night out. This is kind of away from the band now. We'd bump into a member of The View.
Yeah,
it seemed
that.
Everywhere we went. We went to Chatham, we went to Tap and Tin, and Pete was there. We went somewhere in London, Farringdon, and Mo was there. And it was just every time we went, so it was like, oh, and then they always remembered us from that night in Bedford, which is always like it was always a good touch. But
also, Harry, me and Tony, when we used to go out in London, you know, from gigs and stuff, we used to often pretend that we were the Paddington. So don't tell Tom that.
Try and get in somewhere for free or something. Yeah.
If we wanted to get into a club like Coco or whatever, we'd be like, yeah, do you not know we're the Paddings? They're like, oh yeah, go on, get in.
Well, I definitely did the same on a few occasions.
Because because we had it a few times, like back in the younger looking days. I guess there was a very, very small resemblance to Tom, very, very small. I think you got mistaken for Marv quite a few times, didn't you? And it was, and it was like, oh, we can get away with this. We can use this to our advantage.
We also pretended to be the Coot one and impressed it. And we were there with Vernon Kay, and this group of girls said, do you mind if we take a picture of the Coot and ask Vernon Kay to step away? And just took a picture.
We had a mate who was his sister was married to Vernon's best mate, and we ended up being quite good friends. That said, mate Eddie, he was an absolute dead ringer from for the lad from Coot.
Luke.
What's his name?
Luke.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that one was they looked identical. So like everywhere he went, that you'd be walking down the road and someone would ask for a picture or an autograph, whatever. That was, it's always quite funny.
Well, and he just went along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. get girls off the back of it and everything. He loved it.
Yeah, there was a funny story about we went out for a night in Sheffield, and I think I'm saying I wasn't involved in this because I wasn't, but. Two of our mates said they were in a Paddington's to get backstage at this Jamie T gig. And it worked. And one of them, he was a bassist in my band, actually. And he could barely play his instrument. And he picked up this acoustic guitar backstage, apparently, and badly played Wonderwall. And everyone just started walking out. So, yeah, I'll throw him under the bus for that one.
This has just come to me, Frank. Can you remember we went to the Camden Crawl and we actually bumped into Tom again, and we were trying to watch him in Dublin Castle, and it was just impossible to get in to the venue because they obviously, being the Paddingtons, they just had a queue half a mile down the road. But we, knowing that he was in town, we started using it to get into some of the other venues. Do you remember that?
Yeah, we got into Selfish Cunt. Do you remember that?
Yeah. So thinking about it, that day, Camden Crawl, they all knew the Paddingtons were playing there, and we tell them that we're the Paddingtons, and it worked quite well. So cheers for Tom and the boys for playing Camden Crawl, yeah.
Yeah, because it was kind of that level, wasn't it? It was like, no one would really know if you were or you weren't, because you weren't,
exactly.
It wasn't mainstream, but it was like the name was well known kind of thing.
Yeah.
Unless you were in the Liberty, then that was it, yeah.
Yeah. My mates did that in Italy once. A few of them went to Italy and told everyone they were in the Libertines, and they believed them for about 3 days and then turned on them when they did a Google.
See yourself.